Hello, everybody, and welcome to this Joint Institute for Government, UK and a Changing Europe event, the latest in the IFG's general election series. I'm Jill Rutter, and I'm a senior fellow at the IFG and at UK and a Changing Europe, and so it's a delight not to have a split personality today. So, anyway, polls are everywhere at the moment, and I think one confident prediction I can make is that in the run-up to the general election, whenever it is, the poll intensity will only get worse. So today we're going to find out everything we need to know about polling. How to interpret them, how to read them, which ones to believe, which ones to treat maybe more carefully, and how the political parties are going to be using polling in developing their political strategies. And we're doing this to coincide with the launch of a top UK in a Changing Europe leaflet. I'm not sure whether they market tested the hand on that, which to me looks like Homer Simpson with pink nail varnish. Maybe it's Marge, but who knows? But it's a fantastic guide once you've got over the front page to everything you need to know about polling. And it's by our first panellist, Professor Rob Ford, sitting there, and sitting somewhere discreetly in the audience, Sophie Stowers, who is
back
somewhere there and is sort of hiding away. But anyway, well done, Sophie. Well done, sort of, Rob. For the leaflet, Rob, in other existences, is a professor of political science at the University of Manchester and a senior fellow at UK in a Changing Europe. And unfortunately, can't join us in person today, so it's going to loom over us like Big Brother on the screen. Then I'm joined in the room by Kelly Beaver. Kelly is the Chief Executive Officer of Ipsos Mori. On her far left, Christabel Cooper, Director of Research at Labour Together, used to work with Data Praxis and YouGov. And on my right, Tom Lubbock. Tom is the L in JL Partners, and he worked closely with CCHQ and Number 10. So, just a few sort of tips at the start. We'll be live tweeting from at IFG events using the hashtag IFG General Election. Don't think we focus group that hashtag very well, but if you want to join in, do join in and tweet along. If you're watching online, or in an alternative room, because the room here is packed, do send in questions on Slido. And if you like a question and it's very similar to one you might otherwise have asked, please upvote it, because that makes it easier for me to tell where the interest really is. If you're in the room, you can either post your questions on Slido or you can actually stick your hand up and I might just come to you. Anyway, going to kick off without further ado. Rob, going to start with you. You produce this very handy guide to polling, but what are your top tips if we want to be informed consumers of polls in the run-up to a general election? What should we watch out for?
Thank you, Jill, and thanks for inviting me. Sorry I wasn't able to make it in person. It's a bit strange watching myself as a giant floating head, I must say. So first top tip, of course, is to download and digest this marvellous polling guide that we have produced, and massive credit to Sophie Stowers and Zane Moedin for all of their work on that. It's a terrific piece of work and a great read. After you've read that, three further tips for me and three red flags to watch. Tip number one, always remember that polls are snapshots, not predictions. The standard polling voting intention question is, what would you do if there was a general election tomorrow? Now, there isn't a general election tomorrow, so there is still time for people to change their minds. And lots of people will say, honestly and correctly right now, that they don't know what they do. Or they'll tell you, if you ask them, that they might change their minds. So don't treat them as a definitive forecast of what's going to happen in the general election. There is always time for things to change, even in the final days of a campaign. Point number two, polls on the whole, though with some important exceptions, are national snapshots, not local snapshots. And that means they can't tell us a lot about some of the important sources of local variation, most importantly, tactical voting, which I suspect we'll discuss later on. And point number three, polls are all aiming at the same target. The pollsters are all trying to predict the same thing, which is the relative popularity of the parties. And that means that, first of all, you can use the averages. They're useful. They're widely available these days, and use those to judge when pollsters are differing from each other. And when they're differing from each other, that is interesting and useful to know. Now, three quick red flags. Number one, biggest one, I always say to my students, unrepresentative samples. If I do a poll of my Twitter followers, that's not a representative poll. If my son does a poll of his friends on the playground who are all Man United fans, that's not a representative poll either. And it doesn't matter how many Twitter followers you have or how many Man United fans you know, it doesn't make it representative. Pollsters work very hard to generate a representative sample. If you see a poll that doesn't have one, don't take it seriously. Red flag number two, watch out if you see big unexpected results or big unexpected shifts. There's an old rule in polling called Twyman's rule. If a poll looks interesting, it's probably wrong. So if you see something interesting happening, wait and see whether or not several polls say it's happening before treating it too seriously. Point number three, watch out for badly designed questions. People will answer any question you put in front of them in an opinion poll. They want to be helpful, they want to be nice, and they want to look informed. But the answers aren't always useful. And I'll give you one example of a question that doesn't even necessarily look particularly badly designed, but gets asked all the time and really isn't much use. If I ask you, will the following thing affect how you'll vote in the general election? Lots of people will say, yes, it does. That's because you've put that thing in front of them, so now it's at the front of their mind, and people aren't very good at figuring out what influences how they vote in general elections, so they tend to overestimate the influence of what you've just said. Now, that makes for lots of great headlines, particularly from lobbying groups who want to say, my pet issue matters a lot for the general election, but on the whole, it won't. So look carefully at the question and think to yourself, does this question make sense as a way of thinking about how people will behave?
Rob, thanks very much. I'm going to move straight over to Kelly. I wondered if you had any sort of, you know, either tips or red flags to add. And Rob was saying, actually, you know, you need to have lots of results going in the same direction, you know, before you can sort of make too much of that and say a poll has become a bit of a trend. But if you get results that look like a bit of an outlier, do you think, excellent, that's going to be generate some headlines, that's going to generate some interest? Or are you thinking, oh my God, we're looking a bit of an outlier here, are we going to be isolated and look as though we're the polling company that's getting it wrong?
Okay.
And is that a bad news for a commercial polling company?
Thinking about three questions in there, Jill, so just some context. So we've been doing polling, political polling and other polling in this country now for over 50 years. Our methodologies are still telephone for our core voting intention poll, but we use other methodologies for other types of poll that we do around political issues. Just the first part of your question was anything else you would add to what Rob said? And I think, look, a lot of the brochure is brilliant, by the way, and we and others need to do a huge amount about how you interpret the polls and help understanding amongst journalists and the public. So this is great as a thing to have produced. So thank you for that. But looking outside of the voting intention poll, which most of this focuses on, that core number, how are people going to vote? There are lots of polls which look at salience of key issues that matter to voters, how they feel about different politicians and political parties. Those are really interesting as well, and equipping yourself with an understanding of those in the run-up to the election will help you be a bit more informed and a bit more educated. And then the other thing I would probably say is about understanding, if you really want to go beyond the poll of polls and the aggregator for the polls, getting an understanding of what the house effects are for each of the individual pollsters will also help you be informed. We all make choices at each stage in the design process, whether that's about the way the question's worded, the mode through which we poll, or the way in which the representative sample is built. And as a result, what we do with our don't knows and the splits of those. So there are decisions made at each point. And for those who are members of BPC, the British Polling Council, that's all published and it's all in the public domain as soon as a poll is conducted. So again, if you really want to get into the weeds, you can do that there. So that's just a few things on additions.
So should I be worried by a poll by somebody who isn't a member of the British Polling Council? I mean, is that like a sort of statutory regulator or...?
It's not. And I think if I was looking at a poll that was not done by a BPC member or a member of the MRS, I would really look at the methodology, and I would ultimately, they don't have to have the same public, they don't, haven't committed to publishing everything that they've done and all of that methodology, but they still should have something online. And I would probably be a bit more skeptical of it, because you can't see how it's been, like the how, the what, the when, all of the detail that people need to truly interpret the poll. I would be more skeptical and more cautious about it, and I would look at what the BPC members are saying and whether that's contrary or whether it's similar and aligned. In terms of your second bit of your question, which was about whether we, if we are an outlier, and, some, and sometimes we are. I think some of our Scottish polling, you know, is different than, because of, again, some of the choices that we've made, and that we're not re-weighting back to past vote in Scotland, because quite frankly, from our perspective, that was a really long time ago. The census in Scotland hasn't been updated. There's a lot of hope that the history will stand for those who are re-weighting back to that data, and we haven't done that. And you have to be, first of all, if you are an outlier, you know, look at the method, understand what's different between what you've done and what others have done. Does that method justify what you're seeing? And then are you confident in your method and the assumptions you've made? And are you publishing on that in a really clear and articulate way? And ultimately, sometimes you're an outlier and others will follow that trend, because somebody has to be the first mover when something changes, and you have to back yourself, but with a good degree of your own personal skepticism on your methods, and checking and rechecking what you've done, trying it in different ways. So good, healthy degree of personal skepticism and looking at your own results carefully, but also backing yourself and the choices that you make and publishing on them.
I'm going to come to Crispin and Tom in a moment. But Rob, we saw quite a lot a few weeks ago about this big MRP poll that suggested that, you know, Conservatives heading for a virtual wipeout, and, you know, caused lots of sort of concern in individual seats by trying to show what was going to happen. So can you just tell us, I mean, you know, is that a more reliable version than you've talked about averages? Is trying to extrapolate that to individual seat results, is that a useful thing to do? What do we learn from that? Or should we not pay too much attention to these predictions, particularly when seats are being fought on new boundaries and things like that?
I think it's a useful addition to the toolkit that we have when we're trying to assess the landscape. I wouldn't say it's inherently more or less reliable, but it brings something different to the table, because an MRP, it stands for multiple regression and post-stratification. Now, that's a lot of jargon, but the key to that is to recognize that it's a statistical modeling technique. You're combining polling data with other sources of data to try and figure out what's going to happen in every seat. Now, the upside to that is that often it can pick up things that you can't pick up in a national snapshot poll. So, for example, in 2017, YouGov recognised that Labour was doing very well with students. There were lots of students in Canterbury, so their MRP model said that Labour were going to win Canterbury, which had been Conservative for 100 years. Everyone thought this was a very implausible result, but it turned out to be right. So it can be useful when you identify distinctive groups that cluster together in distinctive places. But on the other hand, you're more reliant on the choices you've made in your statistical model. So then you've got two sets of choices. Kelly was talking about the choices pollsters make and how important they are. In MRP, you've got the choices the pollsters have made in the poll that feeds the model, and then you've got the choices that the statistical modelers have made in generating their model too. So that's lots and lots of choices. And, you know, you don't know ahead of time if the choices are going to be right or not. But it does enable us to paint a richer picture of what the electoral map looks like. And sometimes that generates a different reaction, even though they're pointing in the same direction. So actually what the MRPs have been saying, you know, 400 Labour seats, if you just do a very simple uniform projection from current polling, you get to a pretty similar result. I think people are not really realising how bad this election looks for the Conservatives and how good it looks for Labour on the current figures. So sometimes just having that more sort of nuanced model that fills in the map can get people to think about it a bit differently and realise actually what was already there.
So Christabel, Rob set you up brilliantly. You know, Labour's doing fantastically at the moment, consistently sort of 20 points or so ahead. So are they just sort of, are they commissioning any polling themselves? Are they looking at things? Are they just reading the polls and sitting back and smiling? You know, are they using them to think about political strategy? What use is polling when you're just sitting there and every poll says 40 plus, Conservatives 20, not very much?
tempting as it would be just simply to sit back and smile, and I'm old enough, and many other people in the Labour Party are old enough to remember past years when Labour thought they were on course for victory and turned out not to be. So no complacency is very much the watchword. And just, I mean, you know, whilst it does seem that that sort of 20-point lead seems fairly impregnable, just going back to something that, well, both what Rob started with was saying that it is a, you're being asked the question about what would happen if there was a general election tomorrow, and there isn't one. And also what Kelly was saying about some of the methodologies. What we're seeing at the moment is a large number of Conservative 2019 voters are telling pollsters that they don't know who they're going to vote for. Now, different pollsters treat those voters differently. So YouGov, for example, just excludes them altogether. So it's pretending or saying, the model suggests that these people are simply not going to vote. Now, past results suggest that probably the majority of them will vote, and a large number of them will probably vote the way that they voted in the last general election, i.e. return to the Tories. There's also quite a lot of doubt about the switch from Conservative 2019 voters to Reform. And again, different pollsters give very, very different results as to the level of that Reform voting. Again, YouGov gives a very high number for Reform and some others don't. So there is still some doubt about both what the true level of support for Conservatives and Labour are, and also how that will project in an actual general election result.
Interesting. And Christabel, you know, one of the things that you, I'm not sure whether claim credit's the right thing, but one of the things you did was invent this sort of archetype of Stevenage woman, who apparently likes cheap white wine, not looking at anyone in the audience in particular who this might relate to. But are those sort of, you know, archetypes, are concepts like red wall, blue wall, Worcester woman, you know, Workington man, I think we had, didn't we, once from onward. Are they useful at all, or are they just a bit insulting to voters that, you know, we're trying to package you up and put you somewhere?
I think they can be useful. I mean, human beings, like it or not, do like the idea of relating to people, and they find it. So our segmentation, which created Stevenage Woman, was one of six segments we found. It was actually created by an algorithm. But I mean, if we're going to sort of say, well, OK, we've got six clusters here, and this cluster, the mean of this person on the left-right axis is 1.2, and the authoritarian liberal axis is 2.3, that's not a very compelling way of talking about voters, especially to politicians. So, I mean, these are clusters that of people that do have similar attitudes and that we think will think about politics in a similar way. And I think it's useful for politicians to be able to understand the groups of people that they need to be appealing to in order to build a winning coalition, and also to understand how to speak to those people, what their priorities are. But I think, you know, like I say, sort of trying to quote mathematical numbers at people is not going to be a particularly good marketing ploy. So actually, I think creating a sort of an embodiment of some of these things is just really, really helpful, I think, for politicians to understand. And actually, I'm quite pleased about Stevenage Woman, because it was a sort of voter that I think politicians often don't think about a lot. It's somebody who's quite politically disengaged, and I think probably that's the hardest person for people in this room or watching to think about, people who don't think about politics all the time. So what we really wanted to do with that segmentation was actually to point out that most people, you know, they're talking about Celebrity Love Island, they're not talking about, you know, what Angela Rayner's tax affairs or whatever.
How did you know who we had in the front row there, Christabel? That is uncanny, she said. Tom, flip side of Labour, how will the Conservatives be using polling at the moment, other than sort of just an excuse to go and get a drink? You know, and are they focusing on, you know, what issue might turn things round? Well, I think we had Luke Trill from More in Common this morning saying how well the Rishi Sunak smoking ban was polling the 2019 Conservative voters, are obviously quite an important demographic given so many of them, as Kelly was saying, are in the don't know camp at the moment. You know, is that where the Conservatives will be focusing on what might be a turnaround issue? How important is it to get a flight off to Rwanda? Or how will they be thinking about this when these sort of averages just look so grim?
Yeah, I think it's nothing, but nothing makes you less interested in the headline voting intention numbers than actually working in a political party or a political campaign, because there's nothing you can do directly to shift those numbers. You can't, like, change the numbers. Everything you can do to change the headline voting intention number involves starting from somewhere else in the poll, from starting somewhere else with the brand of the Prime Minister or with the brand of the political party or with the policy offer that's being put to voters. So I think that's one interesting tidbit about what the Conservatives will be looking at. They won't be looking at these headline numbers. I mean, what does it matter if you're 20 points, 18 points, 15 points behind? What you want to know is, how can I improve my position, rather than, you know, exactly how far back am I? And so on that, I think, you know, the issues that the day-to-day policies that are being offered to voters are one thing. And I think, again, it's probably the thing that, you know, Radio 4, Guardian, whoever is going to focus on, like, how is Rwanda polling well or badly. But I think we think about things much more in terms, when we're talking about campaigns, much more in terms of brands. So how do you sculpt a politician's brand? How do you sculpt even a corporate brand so that it's resilient, so that it appeals to the most people possible, and so that it has the kind of characteristics that the public are looking for or your customers are looking for? And to do that, you have to really understand in a very, very deep way that you don't get just from looking at the voting intention polls what the public want, how they feel about you, how they feel about the world, and then translate that into actions as a politician, as a party, rather than just thinking about kind of like, if we do smoking ban, maybe 400,000 people more will vote for us. Well, it's basically a bit more complicated than that, and thank God, right? Because otherwise, voters would be really transactional and really boring.
And last week, you produced a poll which told me that if I need a shelf putting up, I would go to Keir Starmer rather than Rishi Sunak. And various other sort of intrigue. I can't remember what Rishi Sunak came top at.
Where I think solving an escape room was one of them.
Yeah, so if I'm in an escape room, I want to be with Rishi Sunak. That's right. It was top of leaving an escape room. So other than suggesting that maybe Keir Starmer beating into us that his dad was a toolmaker, why is that at all helpful to political parties, or was that just a bit of fun?
Yeah, so we don't always focus on the really deep things. And I think the key takeaway from that is, if you need work done at home, get a professional in. Don't ask Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak to do it. I mean, it's about trying to make these things relatable. Yeah. And part of the problem you've got when you're asking, I think Rob and Kelly and Christabel have already all touched on this, that part of the problem you've got when you're surveying people who perhaps don't pay much attention to politics is you're trying to make politics relatable to them. And so one way to do that is to ask questions which relate to more to their everyday lives. And it's like, they know, you know who of your friends you would trust to put up a shelf. You're like, well, they're handy. You know, who would be good in an escape room? Well, I think we all kind of have a sense amongst our friends who'd be good. And it's just another way of adding colour and looking at kind of how the public see politicians below the surface, below those voting intention numbers.
So how useful are focus groups as opposed to just big sample surveys? Obviously, you've only got sort of a few people in the room, might run them in multiple places or whatever. Kelly, I mean, you know, when do you think focus groups really come into their own, and when should people be quite wary about them?
Sure. So we do use them a lot, actually, right across our business, public, private, audience measurement. And in the political space, they're helpful to understand a bit more of the why you're seeing what you're seeing. You do have to remember that it is a small group, and the selection of the focus group participants, you need to be very careful that it's not the same usual suspects turning up, which I think, you know, there are people who do research for a living. So they literally want to do research as part of their livelihood. So you have to be very careful in the selection of your focus group participants and how you've curated them. It is useful. I know that JL Partners do a huge amount of focus groups specifically on politics, and you do get some great one-liners from it. And I enjoy hearing all about those, actually. Yeah. They're good fun.
So you do the ones, don't you? You have a regular slot on Times Radio.
We do.
Yeah.
I think, look, I think focus groups are actually more important than most people do. And I think, yes, they're important for getting at the why, but also they're important as a listening exercise. Mm. It's very hard to listen through an opinion poll. If you really want to listen to your consumers or the public, the best way to do it is to get them in a room, not put too many constraints on them, and let them talk. And what you hear from them in terms of language, in terms of the issues with their lives, in terms of how they think about politics, then becomes a really useful kind of platform to build an opinion poll, to build a campaign on. And so I think, yeah, we think focus groups are more important, I think, than the average.
And Chris Bell, does Labour think focus groups?
Oh, yes, they certainly do. And certainly the organisation that I work for, we use focus groups very much in that way. We will often start off with focus groups and use that to inform an opinion poll. In an opinion poll, you're generally giving people a certain number of options. Mm. For example, what do you think is the most important issue? Maybe the most important issue or the most important aspect of a particular problem is something that none of us would have thought of. Again, you know, we're a very, very small percentage of the population that is this politically engaged. And sometimes you just do need to hear ordinary people say ordinary things and then use that to put that into a poll. Mm.
So we've got a question actually from Anonymous on focus groups saying, and maybe Rob could pick this up, with any red flags on focus groups, but saying, I've heard focus groups are getting harder to put together due to increasing voter apathy. Is that correct, asks Anonymous? Rob?
I'm probably not the best to ask because I don't organise them myself. So I'm sure Christabel and the others on your panel who all do focus groups can answer that. That's not what I've heard at second hand, partly because focus groups often people get paid for their time rather more than they get paid for opinion polls. Actually, poll response rates are more of a concern. The one other thing I wanted to say about focus groups is I also think that they're brilliant and they bring great strengths, but there's one major risk with them, which is that what you hear about with regards to focus groups is very much in the hands of the people organising the focus group. So one story to illustrate how they can be great, the slogan Get Brexit Done, that originated in a focus group. And it was obviously an extremely resonant phrase that maybe they wouldn't have landed on without that focus group. On the other hand, one story about the use of focus groups in the 1990s with New Labour was that Tony Blair, I think, once complained that Philip Gould's focus groups tended remarkably to coincide in their views with what Philip Gould thought was important. And he thought this was quite interesting and wasn't sure what the causal direction was on that. But either is possible, I think.
I think the devil is in the detail, how you've constructed them, brought the groups together, but also who's doing the analysis, how they're doing the analysis, who's cross-checking what they've done, because we all have bias in everything that we do. And so you do extract things from focus groups sometimes with your, you know, you could be doing it with your Whitehall view in mind and get that very, very wrong.
Or just broadcast them on the radio and let the listeners text in saying, this is a load of rubbish. Where'd you find these people?
I love those comments. They make me chuckle a lot.
But, Christabel, do your politicians ever sit and listen to the focus groups as opposed to wait for the reports to come in?
I expect some of them do. I mean, certainly we do. I mean, we're not Labour, but we sit and listen to them and read the transcripts. And, yeah, there is... Tom's point about actually listening to the language that voters use is actually really helpful. I think it's sort of, you feel a kind of much more immediate connection and a much more, it helps a lot with empathy, with actually trying to get inside the minds of people who are perceiving your brand from the outside, which can be really, really hard to do otherwise, I think.
Okay, let's go, we've had quite a good kick around here. Let's go to some questions in the room. I'm going to take them in bunches of three for efficiency, and let's start at the front. Let's go to the lady here and then along this row. That's very efficient. Yes.
Hi, I'm Jo Evans from polling firm White State Insight. My question's particularly to you, Christabel. As you look at influencing policy and shaping ideas around that, how do you balance what the right thing for the country is in Labour's view, or what you think Labour should be doing, and what opinion polls are saying, what would be popular choices?
Okay, and let's plot myself. Okay. And yes.
Hello, Jonathan Rayner, actor. Has there ever been a poll to ask the general public if they trust the election polls results or polls in general?
Okay, that's a very good, very good question. And let's do one more at the front here, and then we'll do the back.
For Kelly particularly, you mentioned telephone polling. Yeah. Now, in the days of landlines, I can see how you can work out who to poll in terms of constituencies. But as far as I'm aware, and this might be ignorance, a mobile phone number doesn't help you locate the voter.
OK, and can you tell us who you are?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm Ivor Gaber, University of Sussex.
Brilliant. Well, let's start with that sort of more technical question to Kelly, and maybe Rob's got a comment. Telephone polling, online polling, landline, desks, mobiles, what do you do?
So our telephone poll, first of all, there are strengths and weaknesses of every modality. So for the telephone, struggles more with young people, actually.
And we're still using landlines.
We use landlines and mobile. It's a random RDD approach, both, and more mobiles than landlines. And we only use telephone because it's very expensive. The other downside is it's an expensive way of doing it, which is largely why I think you'll see majority of the industry, like everybody else, bar one perhaps, who is now using online methodologies, which is a much cheaper way, reduces barriers to entry, etc. But the voting intention poll, which is a national estimate, uses telephone polling.
Forgive me.
No, nobody can hear you. So how do you cope with geography?
It's national, and so therefore you're giving a national estimate. When we do things that are at a lower level, and you ask them geography, so you ask them where they are, so it's a reported piece. But you have a whole range of things that you're asking people when you're doing those to give you an indication of the observable characteristics that you need to feed into any of your models as well. There were other questions.
Rob, let's take this question here about polls on trust in polls. I mean, pollsters had a sort of slightly bad run, didn't they, in the sort of mid-2010s or whatever, with the surprise in 2015, the referendum result, and do the public trust polls or do they just sort of discard them? And do they actually influence voting behaviour? We map that into a question on tactical voting. If I sort of need to know, and some of these mayoral seats I might need to know with the abolition of supplementary vote, how much can I trust the sort of snapshot as guiding me where people are in individual constituencies so I know, if I have a particular objective in a poll, how to vote properly?
Both very interesting questions. On the question of whether pollsters are trusted, they have, I believe, polled on themselves in a sense. I think Maury do the Trust in Different Professions polling. And my recommendation, my recollection is that pollsters are more trusted than journalists, but less trusted than civil servants or academics. So good news for Jill and me, and definitely less trusted than doctors, which is most of my family and always come out top. So they are more trusted than the people reporting them in the press, I believe. I think also what you tend to get is that people don't trust polls that show their party doing badly, which might be one of the things that pulls the pollster's average down somewhat. I mean, I get this whenever I report polls on Twitter. There'll be 100 people in my replies either saying, that's a load of rubbish, everyone I know is voting Tory, or that's a load of rubbish, everyone I know is voting Labour, and that Labour figure is still too low. So they seem to use their informal social network sample and fail to realise it's not a very representative sample. On the question of whether polls could be used to guide tactical voting, I think that's quite interesting because we haven't had many elections where, for example, MRPs have been available that give like a better estimate of what's going on in constituencies. And the honest answer is I don't know. It could do if people consume it. But I suspect the kind of people that pick up that sort of stuff probably know what they're going to do anyway. So I'm old school. I think that all the leaflets that will be dropping onto everyone's doorsteps in the weeks up to the election with various dubious bar charts explaining who's first and second are probably going to be more important, because those are the kinds of things that people who aren't generally engaged in politics will actually pick up on. I don't think the average voter who's more inclined to be following Love Island is going to be Googling MRPs and going on the interactive maps. More's the pity, but that's how it is.
Just a question. There's a poll that's just been published today showing Andy Street quite a long way behind his Labour challenger in for the West Midlands mayoral combined authority, but quite a high vote for Reform there. And if you took Reform plus Andy Street, he would be sort of up level. Obviously, there are Lib Dems and Greens as well, who you might assume might go, you know, probably in a second round would have gone over to Labour, but only one round this time. When I'm answering the question, am I answering the question of who would I really like to vote for, or in the circumstances, who will I actually vote for given the result? I mean, what question do people think they're answering in a sort of first-past-the-post poll?
Is this to me?
Yeah, to you or to Kelly, yeah.
It's hard to tell from the camera. I think the West Midlands poll, I mean, I think all the mayoral polling this time, and I wish there was more of it, is going to be interesting because the electoral system has changed and it's not clear that voters are aware of that. So it could be that you're getting a lot more people saying they'll support smaller parties because they don't realise they've only got one choice this time. And it may be one of the jobs of the campaigns for the big two parties is to explain to people what's changed. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not those smaller party numbers get squeezed down as we approach election day, as people learn about the change. As you say, at the moment, the irony is that the Conservatives made this switch, and there was a lot of argument that it was partisan self-interest, that they were doing this because they thought they would win more mayoralties this way. And if Andy Street ends up losing because a lot of people who would put him second are voting Reform, then it will have had the opposite effect. Mm.
Kelly, do you?
I'm still not convinced I understood your question, what you were asking, Jill.
So my question is when I'm asked how would I vote tomorrow,
yeah.
Do I either say, well, this is the party I like, or actually, given the result I want, this is how I will vote in my specific constituency.
So there's been a lot of cognitive testing of different questions to understand what the best question is to elicit a voting intention response. And so you'll see a lot of the voting intention questions used by pollsters are very, very similar, so that it gives a better understanding of, as they stand today, how do they physically think they're going to go and vote? So there are lots of different permutations of that that have been tested throughout the years, and you'll see that most of the pollsters are using the same wording for voting intention. That's for a reason. It's not by sort of magic that's materialised in that way. And on your question on trust, if I may, there is a veracity index which we poll on a regular basis, which asks about pollsters and how you trust them. And I do a lot of speeches to different people from different professions, and I always show the veracity index about how their profession is trusted. And I have to show some humility there, because the pollsters we're decidedly average in that long list. We're somewhere in the middle of the various different professions, from ad executives and politicians down at the bottom, right up to nurses and doctors and scientists, which are closer to the top. Well, so we don't actually, you know, I am minded to do another poll on, it's difficult to do one on yourself. It's really difficult to do it on yourself, but the industry more generally, yeah.
Okay, and so the question to Christabel about, you know, popularity, I mean, how far does that sort of weigh when you get results versus doing the right thing? And I'm going to come to Tom for the same question.
Well, I don't think any political party should be going into any election. I mean, you know, the point of joining a political party is because you think that there are things that would benefit the country and that your party can offer those things. So no party should be sort of going to a survey panel with a blank sheet of paper and saying, OK, tell me what we should be doing. Mostly because the public will just say, I just want lots of free things and not have to pay for them, which isn't a particularly helpful answer anyway. So, I mean, I think, you know, a political party should have a broad agenda that it wants to deliver. But I think what polling does is it helps tell them where the limits are of where they can push the policies that they want. And it also helps tell them how to tell a story about the policies that it wants to advocate. So, I mean, you know, in the end, we live in a democracy. There are lots of political actors who would love to do loads of things, but, you know, we accept in the end that the people do have a right to have a view on what politicians want to do. And, I mean, my old career, I used to work for Marks & Spencer, and so used to look at what people thought of Marks & Spencer. And an ex-CEO once said that M&S needed to be about half a step ahead of the public. Because it's a mainstream retailer, can't be sort of cutting edge fashion because no one's going to buy that. But on the other hand, doesn't want to be just following people. It needs to be able to curate a collection of clothes that people want to, that people will say, okay, yeah, okay, I realise now that that's what I want to buy. So I think for a mainstream political party, that's probably where they want to be.
Tom, have you got anything to add on? Do you just go with what's popular or...? Do you do the right thing?
One thing to add on the question of do people trust the polls, I haven't seen that polled, and we will poll it. So
okay.
That's one takeaway.
Will they trust the results of that poll?
We will see. It'll be interesting to see what the breakdown is anyway.
Very meta.
I actually think, anyway. Parties just do things that are popular. I mean, it's terrible, terrible idea, but on the flip side, don't do things that are, you know, they shouldn't do things that are unpopular. Neither of those statements is totally true. Sometimes, you know, you have to understand that politicians can lead the public. Mm. So people have quite loosely held views on lots of things. Mm. And if you have a kind of core preference for a strong leader, someone who speaks about things honestly and relates to you, then the chances are you will be led by that person. And I don't think British politics has seen someone like that since Tony Blair left power. I mean, there was brief kind of Rory Stewart flirtation that the public had. But, you know, it's possible to lead the public, but you do have to know where to lead and where to steer clear of. So don't just do things that are popular. But, yeah, a bit more complicated.
So just building on that, we saw during the 2010 election, didn't we? That sort of big sort of CLEG surge that came and then sort of was reflected in polling and then went again. And I've got one or two questions coming in on Slido about George Charles has asked, you know, does the long string of polls showing very large Labour leads risk inducing confirmation bias about this? And, you know, maybe even people who might want Labour to win but don't think that they should have a massive landslide. Does that potentially change voting choices and voting behaviour? And another question from Anonymous on the other side, which is whether shy Toryism is still a phenomenon or not. And we've got, you know, are these don't know red wallers actually ones who, you know, just don't want to admit that maybe they still will vote Conservative or whatever? So how should we read those? Do the polls actually affect the outcome, particularly as we get close to maybe during the campaign?
Yeah.
Tom, do you want to?
Should I do the shy Tories and
do
that
some
side
shy
of things?
Tories for us? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean they're very very shy at the moment. if you're a Conservative, I think look the one area at the moment where I think things the polls may be endogenous and feeding back into politics is on the Reform vote, and I think Nigel Farage has said himself that he's waiting to see if Reform draw level with the Conservatives before actually jumping into the race. Whether or not he does, I don't know. But I think, you know, unless without getting double digits in multiple polls, Reform would not be taken as seriously as they are, and that then feeds back into their national standing. But you know, I think the danger is you say, well, this is a terrible thing. Polls are influencing the way politics works. But the polls are just a reflection of what the public are saying at some level. And so it's a useful feedback mechanism. And, you know, if there are a group of people out there who feel really strongly about something, we want to hear from them.
Mm. Kelly?
Well, I think what's one of my favourite pages in this booklet, which I will show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Where's the page where it says, what would happen if there are no polls?
Yeah.
And it talks about how outside influences start to manipulate truth and create a new version of truth, which is not truth. And the polls, at their core, are trying to get a true and representative view of what the public think and feed that to the public who have demand for that information. And I don't believe, certainly our organisation does not profit in any way from political polling. We don't work for any of the political parties. It's an independent public good that we're providing by collating the information and publishing it with a reputable way. And I think that's one of my favourite pieces, how the politicians use it and how it is taken and utilised is a step beyond our remit.
Rob, be interested in your comments on, you know, voting's effect on or polling's effect on voters, actually, that sort of feedback loop. But also, sometimes we see parties saying, you know, our private polling is showing this. What's that all about? Is there really some sort of different sort of polling that is going on? That are they asking different questions, or is it just, you know, I'm trying to throw a bit of sort of mud in the face and, you know, don't believe what's going on, but is there anything to it? Is there any such thing as private polling?
Well, I think you've always got to be a bit sort of wary and sceptical of a party that's not doing very well in the polls says, oh, well, I've got a private poll that shows I'm very popular, but you can't see it. It goes to another school. I would be... all parties do private polling, and sometimes it does show up things that aren't necessarily clear in the public polling. But you've got to remember, whatever they're telling us about their private polling is a strategic decision in itself. So it's never going to be, you know, a neutral and full disclosure like is true with the independent pollsters. And I think this does relate to the point about polling influencing voters and what happens if there isn't polling and so on. I mean, one of my favourite sort of campaign stories, which I think also is in the booklet, is in Poland, as in a number of European countries, they ban opinion polls for the final couple of weeks of the campaign, which is supposedly to provide a kind of moment of reflection where voters weigh everything up without the distraction of polling and without being influenced by polling. But that isn't what happens at all in practice. What happens on social media in Poland during the period when the polls are banned is a so-called market opens up, and prices are posted in this market on pistachios and on coriander. Now, why is that? Because the two leading parties in Poland are PIS, Law and Justice, and KO, Civic Coalition. And these prices on the market are, in fact, what people are claiming private polls are showing that are not in the public domain. So nature abhors a vacuum. People want to know what's happening in the final stages of the campaign. If that information isn't available publicly, then worse information of uncertain origin will float around in the market and influence voters, but without any kind of transparency or accountability. So I think it is possible that voters get influenced by polls. It's certainly true that they want to know what's happening in polling. And given those two things, the best we can do is to make polling as transparent and public and independent as possible.
Okay.
If I can just add, there was a lot of talk in the 2017 election about how perhaps lots of people voted Labour because they didn't expect Jeremy Corbyn to do all that well. And just to the point, In fact, that turned out not to be true. Most of the people who voted Labour actually thought Labour were going to win. I can say I was not one of them. But it's kind of interesting. I don't think that the fact that Labour are really far ahead in the polls at the moment will necessarily then mean that people will stop voting Labour. Basically, people want their party to win. It's a kind of, you know, and going back to the point about sort of all the do people trust pollsters, they tend to trust the polls that tell them that the party that they want to vote for is going to win. So I think that that's the sort of probably the way round it operates rather than the other way round.
Okay, let's go to some more questions from the audience. Yes, so we've got another crop. Let's do the back crop, Lauren. So there and then... Let's take four in a very efficient crop. Yes.
Kieran Walters, Prospect Union. We've seen the electorate become ever more volatile. The public identifying less with parties overall in a less long-term way. It's been touched on already, but what's the challenge, if any, for pollsters in doing polling in that environment, how things are changing?
Okay, yes, and then right next to you.
Andrew Smith, last week there were two polls for the London mayoral election. One showed Sadiq Khan with a 25% lead, which was consistent with prior ones, and the other showed just a 13% lead. Is there any way in which both polls are valid?
Okay, and I think there were some more people. Yes.
Thanks. I'm Matt. I'm a maths teacher. Notwithstanding that polls are not predictions, they're snapshots, it seems that a don't know proportion is quite big at the moment. I wondered how that's getting taken into account and whether everyone that gets asked does end up voting or whether some of those don't knows don't vote, et cetera.
And I think the gentleman immediately next to you, yes.
Very efficient. I'm Phil, just a member of the public. Do you think MRP polls will have much of an influence on tactical voting.
Yeah, I think we've discussed that a little bit. So if any other panellists want to pick up MRP tactical voting when I read what's going to happen in my seat. But Kelly, this point about volatility and don't knows, which are slightly related, aren't they, with people sort of shifting allegiances. Is this making, is your task getting much harder, basically?
So what I would say
or to more you interesting.
Is, yeah, it's always interesting doing this job, Jill. Mm-hmm. This is a brilliant job. We get to observe the public at scale, which is fascinating. So at Ipsos, we look at lots of things, not just politics. And what we've seen is that from the beginning of this decade, we have seen much more volatility, not just in terms of public attitudes and you know, what they tell us, but at the fundamentals of their core value sets. Mm. Some things that haven't moved for a long time in terms of public values and sentiment around that have started to move. And that we've coined the restless decade. It hasn't quite caught on in the way Stevenage Woman has yet, but it is a concept, and we have seen more volatility in movement, not just around politics, but around a whole range of issues where we measure societal and consumer trends as well. So it makes you really double check what you're seeing, I would say, when we see movements that we're not anticipating, and it makes you seek to corroborate it with other sources as well. So we are full service. We do face-to-face, telephone, online, social media analytics, you name it. We utilise it still. And as a result, you do use more methods to sense check what you're seeing in perhaps what would be a normal quantitative poll. So yes, there's more volatility. Not everything is changing and not everything's as volatile as you think it is, but there's definitely, since the beginning of this decade, we have seen more movement in certain indicators, including those that haven't moved for some time.
So Rob, what's the best way for a pollster to deal with don't knows or people whose voting intention isn't clear? I mean, what are the sort of options and what's the best way of treating those people? I was just listening to the George Osborne, Ed Balls podcast about Brexit, and George Osborne was saying, well, of course, the thing that everybody got wrong on Brexit was the assumption that people who didn't vote in general elections wouldn't vote in the referendum, and that's why people thought Remain would win and et cetera, you know. But then those people who stopped voting don't go back to voting in general elections.
Well, I mean, the best way to deal with don't know modelling and with turnout modelling is the way that delivers the right result on election day. But unfortunately, pollsters don't have time machines, so they don't know what the right way to deal with these things is going to be ahead of time. And the right answer can change. So I know of one pollster who will remain anonymous who told me that if they'd have applied the methods they used in 2017 and 2019, they would have been right. And if they'd applied the methods they used in 2019 and 2017, they would have been right. But they did it the other way around and were wrong both times, because the behaviour of the electorate changed in terms of how the don't knows broke, in terms of who turned out and who didn't, and so on. And pollsters just have to make their best judgment ahead of time as to how they think those things are going to pan out. And I actually think it's a very healthy thing for the polling industry as a whole and for the polling consumer that different pollsters are taking different views on, for example, the issue of don't knows right now. So some pollsters are excluding them. We've talked about that. Some pollsters are downweighting them rather than excluding them entirely. Some are winding them back to what they did the previous time. I think Opinium in particular does that and gets a higher conservative share. And I think given that we know that, they're fully transparent about that, and we can see the impact that has on the results, that helps us because it reveals a source of uncertainty and it shows what different decisions on that source of uncertainty, what impact that would have. Which brings us to the point about the two very different London polls. That's another example of where we have a lot of uncertainty because, number one, London is a lower turnout election. Number two, we know that some people do behave differently in London mayoral elections to Westminster elections. And number three, we know that Sadiq Khan is not a particularly popular incumbent at the moment. His approval ratings are not that high. Now, how all of that will shake out in a very pro-Labour national environment is really not obvious, and different pollsters are going to come to different conclusions about how to deal with those issues. And again, I think it's probably a good thing that two different pollsters have come to different answers on those things, provided we can figure out the workings, provided we can figure out how they've arrived at that answers, because that gives us some sort of a sense of what may or may not matter in trying to figure out Sadiq Khan's chances next month, just as with don't knows, we're trying to figure out what will happen at Westminster 6-7 months from now.
Any comments on the mayoral elections?
Yeah, I entirely agree with what Rob just said. Just in general, polls do tend to overstate Labour's lead in mayoral elections. Again, you know, from what Rob was saying about the particular nature of the electorate in London, full of young people, full of ethnic minorities, both of whom tend to have low political engagement, but pollsters will tend to find people with high political engagement, so may not be representative. So, I mean, you know, again, as from a pessimistic Labour point of view, I'd probably believe the lower one rather than the higher one, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. I was just going to take the question about MRPs and tactical voting. Yeah. We did some work on tactical voting, and what we found was there is a lot of willingness amongst non-Tory voters to switch between parties in order to defeat the Tory candidate. However, what we also found was that there was quite a profound level of ignorance about who came second in your constituency last time. That's been particularly complicated by the fact, of course, there's boundary changes at the moment. So I think from recollection, it was only something like 20% of people could name correctly name which party came second in their constituency last time. I think, so, however, something like sort of 80% of people claimed they knew who they should be voting for tactically, so slight discrepancy between those numbers. I haven't looked at the gender breakdown of that, but I can guess what it is. I'm unconvinced that most members of the public are going to be looking at MRPs. And of course, MRPs can be difficult, cannot be great predictors of who you should be voting for tactically either. Sort of disclaimer, my friend is the Labour candidate in Finchley and Golders Green, where the Lib Dems came second under fairly extraordinary circumstances. Of course, highest Jewish population in the country, and Luciana Burgess stood for the Lib Dems. But MRPs have got quite a lot of trouble unwinding that particular effect. And I think there's broad consensus, I think, even amongst the Lib Dems, that that's not a Lib Dem target seat. So it can be quite difficult to determine. And I think in the end, I think Rob made the point earlier, what will probably influence voters more is the amount of leaflets that come through the door, the amount of, you know, people that they see on the street. You know, in every by-election so far, the political parties have managed to work out who should be the main challengers to the Tories. And without actually withdrawing, they have managed to signal by their presence or their absence who you should be voting for in order to defeat the Conservative candidate.
I just wanted to pick up what Christabel was saying about minority voters and maybe also a bit on Scotland as being a sort of interesting battleground with lots of these sort of three-party marginals and things like that. I mean, how good are the polls at sort of working out some of these local effects? We see, you know, is Labour's stance on Israel-Gaza going to alienate Muslim voters? Does that matter? You know, what about, you know, competitiveness in Scotland, which is now a battleground, having been not really a battleground last whatever? Tom, how difficult are these things to pick up on?
I guess I've got some recent experience of polling minorities in the UK, and that we did a poll for Henry Jackson Society of British Muslims. And, you know, very, very expensive thing to do, like so expensive, a bit like polling in Scotland's quite expensive as well. Like, these are not big areas, these are not big groups that we're polling. And so the problem is that the money simply isn't there most of the time to do regular polling of British Muslims, say, or even for us anyway. We don't have a regular tracker of Scotland. And you don't necessarily get, you know, sticking your neck out and doing a poll like that doesn't necessarily win you any friends. In fact, you know, lots of people were highly, highly unfairly critical of that poll simply because they didn't like what it said. So, you know, there's that trade-off there. It's very expensive. You don't necessarily you know, get the credit for doing that. And I think that's why you don't see a range of different polls in the UK. It's just NatRep, nationally representative poll after nationally representative poll.
I think it is where qualitative methods really come into their own, though exploring issues that are more sensitive, more heightened, where you can dig a bit deeper and listen a bit more. That is where the qualitative methodologies add something really rich and important, I think, to the tapestry of what you can do.
I mean, Rob, what You think, I mean, are we going to see some distinct sort of local effects by different sort of ethnic minority representation? Are the polls, you know, we see that, you know, Anas Sawar and Labour seem to be overtaken, Scottish Labour seem to be very competitive with the SNP, if not getting slightly, should we say, well, actually, you know, polling in Scotland's very difficult, so we don't really know what's going on? How should we interpret those sort of more, if you like, micro results?
I mean, Scotland and ethnic minorities is two really interesting case studies in, you know, potentially very important distinctive groups. Scotland is probably more important for the general election because of the geography of the vote in Scotland. So where we are now in the Scottish national polling, it's very, very close to a tipping point where the SNP start to lose loads of seats and Labour gain loads of seats. A few percentage points either way can be 15, 20 seat difference. So really, there should be lots of polling of Scotland given that, because it could be very consequential for the general election. But as your fellow panellists have pointed out, polling in Scotland is expensive, and the polling industry and the media industry that pays for polls is mainly based in London, and sad to say, still doesn't pay as much attention to Scotland as perhaps it should do, given the nature of the electoral battlefield. The ethnic minority situation, I think, is rather different. Ethnic minorities are also very politically distinctive and have been for a very long time, but partly as a consequence, and that plus the fact that they cluster together very densely in particular seats, means that you'd have to have a really huge change in ethnic minority political behaviour for it to have any meaningful impact in terms of seats. I mean, I ran through, there have been now three polls of British Muslims in the last 6 months or so, and credit to JL Partners for being one of them, because as has been pointed out, these are expensive, difficult to do, and this is an important group with distinctive views on many things. However, in all three of those polls, there's been a drop in Labour support. But if you apply that drop in Labour support across all of the seats, it's unlikely to put a single seat in jeopardy. Mm. Whereas a similarly sized change in support in Scotland could mean dozens of seats changing hands. Yeah. So it is a different situation in terms of the electoral map. However, that said, ethnic minority voters are a big community. They're distinctive on many, many issues. There's potential for them to become volatile in future. And currently, they're not systematically polled on a regular basis, in part because doing so is very, very expensive. That's very different to the US, for example, where it's just standard to have polls of Latino and African Americans on a regular basis. So that is a structural hole, I think, currently in polling and public opinion. And really, I think one that should be addressed, for example, by the research councils and the academic community more generally, if it's not really something that's commercially viable, because we need to know about those groups. We're speculating about them anyway, and we need to have more information to base that speculation on.
And I think it's a very helpful UK in a Changing Europe publication about to come about that, isn't there, Rob? She said.
I believe so, yes.
I will. I just wanted to ask the panellists, we're going to have to wind up, one last question. Will voter ID make any difference to this? Are you factoring that into your polling? Kelly, anything?
God, I wish I had my polling team with me to answer that question. I'm sure they are, Jill. I'm sure they are, but perhaps somebody else can take that one.
Anyone on voter ID? Remember, everybody, elections, voter ID necessary, she said. My plug for that. Anyway.
Tiny effect, and it's just another function of turnout, and turnout is incredibly hard to model anyway. So it's all chuck it all into it's the turnout model.
Another thing people can blame if the polls don't look out like the results. But anyway, another volatile factor. I'm going to call it to a close there. Could I ask you to thank our fantastic panel? Could I thank UK and Changing Europe for partnering with Institute for Government at that event. Plugs for two further events. Next Wednesday, a week on Wednesday, UK and Changing Europe has an already sold out but available online, Unlocked in the evening with John Curtis. So if you're interested in polling, you want to find out, you know, everything you always want to know about John Curtis, maybe a bit about polling as well. And the very next day, Institute for Government has the next in their general election series on Can Any Government Do Anything to Improve Ethical Standards, or some such title like that. So do sign up for that and come along to that. Thank you all very much for coming. And this will be available on the Institute for Government website very, very shortly. Tell all your friends. Thanks very much for all your fantastic questions. Thanks to people online. very many apologies to people in the room whose questions I didn't get to, but as one of my colleagues said, we really should have scheduled longer for this. Mm. So we really should have scheduled longer for this. So thank you very much, and see you outside.